In the semis, I'm due to play Robbie Ginepri, a touted kid from Georgia. CBS wants mine to be the late match. I go to the tournament director on my knees. I tell him, if I'm lucky enough to get through this match, I'll have to come back tomorrow. Please, don't make a 35-year-old man get home later than his 22-year-old opponent in the final. He reschedules my match, makes it the early semi. After 2 5-setters in a row, no one gives me a chance against Ginepri. He's fast, solid off both sides, playing the best tennis of his life, and young. And even before dealing with Ginepri, I know the first thing I'll have to do is chisel through a wall of my own fatigue. The last 3 sets against Blake are the best tennis I've ever played, and the most draining. I tell myself to come out against Ginepri and manufacture adrenaline, pretend I'm down 2 sets, try to relocate that mindless state I found against Blake. It works. Feigning urgency, I win the 1st set. Now my goal is to conserve energy for tomorrow's final. I begin to play safe tennis, thinking about my next opponent, and of course, that lets Ginepri swing freely, take chances. He wins the 2nd set. I banish from my mind all thought of the final. I give Ginepri my full attention. He's gassed after expending so much energy to tie the match, and I win the 3rd, but he wins the 4th. I need to start the 5th with fury. I also need to acknowledge that I can't win every point. I can't run after everything, can't lunge for each dink and drop. I can't go full speed against a kid who's still teething. He wants to be out here all night, but I have 45 minutes of energy left, 45 minutes of a functioning body, or maybe just 35. I win the set. It's not possible, but I'm in the final of the U.S. Open at 35 years old. Darren, Gil, and Stephanie scoop me off the locker room floor and go into triage mode. Darren grabs my rackets and runs them to Roman, the stringer. Gil hands me my Gil water. Stephanie helps me to the car. We race back to the Four Seasons to watch Federer and Hewitt fight for the privilege of playing the old cripple from Vegas. It's the most relaxed you can be before a final, watching the other semi. You tell yourself, whatever I'm feeling at this moment, it's better than what those guys are feeling. Then Federer wins, of course. I lean back on the couch, and he's all I'm thinking about. And I know somewhere out there, I'm all he's thinking about. Between now and tomorrow afternoon, I need to do everything a little better than he does it, including sleep. But I have children. I used to sleep until 11:30 in the morning on the day of a match. Now I can't sleep later than 7:30. Stephanie keeps the children quiet, but something in my body knows they're up. They want to see their father. More, their father wants to see them. After breakfast, I kiss them goodbye. Driving to the stadium with Gil, I'm quiet. I know I have no chance. I'm ancient. I've played 3 5-setters in a row. Let's be real. My only hope is if it goes for 3 or 4 sets. If it's a fast match where conditioning doesn't come into play, I might get lucky. Federer comes onto the court looking like Cary Grant. I almost wonder if he's going to play in an ascot and a smoking jacket. He's permanently smooth. I'm constantly rattled, even when serving at 40-15. He's also dangerous from so many different parts of the court. There's nowhere to hide. I don't do well when there's nowhere to hide. Federer wins the 1st set. I go into frantic mode, do anything I can to knock him off balance. I get up a break in the 2nd. I break again and win the set. I think to myself, Mr. Grant might just have a problem today. In the 3rd set, I break him and go up 4-2. I'm serving with a breeze at my back, and Federer is shanking balls. I'm about to go up 5-2, and, for a fleeting moment, He and I both think something remarkable is about to happen here. We lock eyes. We share a moment. Then, at 30 love, I hit a kick serve to his backhand. He takes a swing, shanks it. The ball sounds sick as it leaves his racket, like one of my deliberate misfires as a kid. But this sick, ugly misfire somehow wobbles over the net and lands in. Winner. He breaks me, and we're back on serve. In the tiebreak, he goes to a place that I don't recognize. He finds a gear that other players simply don't have. He wins 7-1. Now the shit is rolling downhill and doesn't stop. My quads are screaming. My bag is closing the store for the night. My decisions become poor. I'm reminded how slight the margin can be on a tennis court, how narrow the space between greatness and mediocrity, fame and anonymity, happiness and despair. We were playing a tight match. We were dead even. Now, due to a tiebreak that made my jaw drop with admiration, the rout is on. Walking to the net, I'm certain that I've lost to the better man, the Everest of the next generation. I pity the young players who will have to contend with him. I feel for the man who is fated to play Agassi to his Sampras. Though I don't mention Pete by name, I have him uppermost in my mind when I tell reporters, it's real simple. Most people have weaknesses. Federer has none. Chapter 29. I pull out of the 2006 Australian Open, then pull out of the entire clay season. I hate to do it, but I need to save myself for the 2006 Wimbledon, which I quietly, privately decide will be my last. I'm saving myself for Wimbledon. I never thought I'd say such a thing. I never dreamed a proper, respectful goodbye to Wimbledon would feel so important. But Wimbledon has become hallowed ground for me. It's where my wife shined. It's where I first suspected that I could win, and where I proved it to myself and the world. Wimbledon is where I learned to bow, to bend my knee, to do something I didn't want to do, wear what I didn't want to wear, and survive. Also, no matter how I feel about tennis, the game is my home. I hated home as a boy, and then I left, and I soon found myself homesick. In the final hours of my career, I'm continually chastened by that memory. I tell Darren this will be my last Wimbledon, and the coming U.S. Open will be my last tournament ever. We make the announcement just as Wimbledon gets underway. Immediately after, I'm startled by how differently my peers look at me. They no longer treat me as a rival, a threat. I'm retired. I'm irrelevant. A wall is let down. Reporters ask, "Why now? Why did you choose to retire now?" I tell them I didn't. I simply can't play anymore. That's the finish line I've been seeking, the finish line with the inexorable pull. Can't play as opposed to won't play. Unwittingly, I've been seeking that moment when I'd have no choice. Bud Collins, the venerable tennis commentator and historian, the co-author of Laver's autobiography, sums up my career by saying, "I've gone from punk to paragon." I cringe. To my thinking, Bud sacrificed the truth on the altar of alliteration. I was never a punk any more than I'm now a paragon. Also, several sports writers muse about my transformation, and that word rankles. I think it misses the mark. Transformation is change from one thing to another, but I started as nothing. I didn't transform, I formed. When I broke into tennis, I was like most kids. I didn't know who I was, and I rebelled at being told by other people. I think older people make this mistake all the time with younger people, treating them as finished products when in fact they're in process. It's like judging a match before it's over, and I've come from behind too often, and had too many opponents come roaring back against me to think that's a good idea. What people see now, for better or worse, is my first formation, my first incarnation. I didn't alter my image, I discovered it. I didn't change my mind, I opened it. JP helps me work through this idea, explain it to myself. He says, people have been fooled by my changing looks, my clothes and hair, into thinking that I know who I am. People see my self-exploration as self-expression. He says that, for a man with so many fleeting identities, it's shocking and symbolic that my initials are AKA. Sadly, in the early summer of 2006, despite the best efforts of JP and others, I can't yet explain this to reporters. Even if I could, the press room at the All England Club isn't the place. I can't explain it to Stephanie either, but I don't need to. She knows all. In the days and hours leading up to Wimbledon, she stares into my eyes and pats my cheek. She talks to me about my career. She talks about hers. She tells me about her last Wimbledon. She didn't know it would be her last. She says it's better this way, to know, to go out on my own terms. Wearing a necklace made for me by Jaden, a chain of block letters that spells out, Daddy Rocks, I face Boris Pashansky from Serbia in the first round. As I step on the court, the applause is loud and long. On the first serve, I can't see the court because my eyes are filled with tears. Despite feeling as if I'm playing in a suit of armor with a back that will not loosen, I persist, endure. I win. In the second round, I beat Andreas Seppi from Italy in straight sets. I'm playing well, which gives me hope going into my third round match against Nadal. He's a brute, a freak, a force of nature, as strong and balletic a player as I've ever seen. But I feel the delusional effects of winning, that I might be able to make inroads. I like my chances. I lose the first set 7-6, but take hope from how close it was. Then he annihilates me. The match takes 70 minutes. My window of opportunity is 55. That's when I start to feel my back. Late in the match, with Nadal serving, I can no longer stand still. I need to move around, stomp my foot, get the blood flowing. The stiffness is so severe, the pain so great, returning is the last thing on my mind. I'm thinking only of remaining vertical. After, in a moment dripping with irony, Wimbledon officials break with tradition to hold an on-court interview with Nadal and me. They never hold on-court interviews. I tell Gil, sooner or later, I knew I'd get Wimbledon to break with tradition. Gil isn't laughing. He never laughs while a fight is still on. It's almost over, I tell him. I go to Washington, D.C., and play an Italian qualifier named Andrea Stoppini. He beats me as if I'm the qualifier, and I feel ashamed. I thought I needed a tune-up for the U.S. Open, but this tune-up has left me shaken. I tell reporters that I'm struggling with the end more than I expected. I tell them that the best way I can explain it is this. Many of you, I'm sure, don't like your jobs. But imagine if someone told you right now that your story about me would be your last. After this, you'll never be able to write another word for as long as you live. How would you feel? Everyone travels to New York. The whole team. Stephanie, the children, my parents, Perry, Gil, Darren, Philly. We invade the Four Seasons and colonize Campagnola. The children smile to hear the applause as we walk in. To my ear, the applause sounds different this time. It has a different timbre. It has a subtext. They know this isn't about me. It's about all of us finishing something special together. Frankie seats us at the corner table. He makes a big fuss over Stephanie and the children. I watch him serve Jaden all my favorite foods and I watch Jaden enjoy them. I watch Jazz enjoy the food too, though she insists that every entree remains separate. They mustn't touch. A variation of the blueberry muffin imperative. I watch Stephanie watching the kids, smiling, and I think of the four of us, four distinct personalities, four different surfaces, and yet a matching set, complete. On the eve of my final tournament, I enjoy that sense we all seek, that knowledge we get only a few times in life, that the themes of our life are connected, the seeds of our ending were there in the beginning, and vice versa. In the first round, I play Andrei Pavel from Romania. My back seizes up midway through the match, but despite standing stick straight, I manage to tough out a win. I ask Darren to arrange a cortisone shot for the next day. Even with the shot, I don't know if I'll be able to play my next match. I certainly won't be able to win. Not against Marcos Bogdatis. He's ranked number 8 in the world. He's a big, strong kid from Cyprus, in the midst of a great year. He's reached the final of the Australian Open and the semis of Wimbledon. And then, somehow, I beat him. Afterward, I'm barely able to stagger up the tunnel and into the locker room before my back gives out. Darren and Gil lift me like a bag of laundry onto the training table, while Bogdatis's people hoist him onto the table beside me. He's cramping badly. Stephanie appears, kisses me. Gil forces me to drink something. A trainer says the doctors are on the way. He turns on the TV above the table, and everyone clears out, leaving just me and Bogdatis, both of us writhing and groaning in pain. The TV shows highlights from our match. Sports Center. In my peripheral vision, I detect slight movement. I turn to see Bogdatis extending his hand. His face says, "We did that." I reach out, take his hand, and we remain this way, holding hands, as the TV flickers with scenes of our savage battle. We relive the match, and then I relive my life. Finally, the doctors arrive. It takes them and the trainers half an hour to get Bogdatis and me on our feet. Bogdatis leaves the locker room first, gingerly, leaning against his coach. Then Gil and Darren lead me out to the parking lot, enticing me forward a few steps with the thought of a cheeseburger and a martini at P.J. Clark's. It's 2 in the morning. "Christ," Darren says as we emerge into the parking lot. "The car is all the way over there, mate." We squint at the lone car in the middle of the empty parking lot. It's several hundred yards away. I tell him I can't make it. "No, of course not," he says. "Wait here and I'll bring it around." He runs off. I tell Gil that I can't stay upright. I need to lie down while we wait. He sets my tennis bag on the cement and I sit, then lie back, using the bag as a pillow. I look up at Gil. I see nothing but his smile and his shoulders. I look just beyond his shoulders at the stars. So many stars. I look at the light stanchions that rim the stadium. They seem like bigger, closer stars. Suddenly, an explosion. A sound like a giant can of tennis balls being opened. One stanchion goes out. Then another and another. I close my eyes. It's over. No. Hell no. It will never really be over. I'm hobbling through the lobby of the Four Seasons the next morning when a man steps out of the shadows. He grabs my arm. "Quit," he says. "What?" It's my father, or a ghost of my father. He looks ashen. He looks as if he hasn't slept in weeks. "Pops, what are you talking about?"
"Just quit. Go home. You did it. It's over."
He says he prays for me to retire. He says he can't wait for me to be done so he won't have to watch me suffer anymore. He won't have to sit through my matches with his heart in his mouth. He won't have to stay up until 2 in the morning to catch a match from the other side of the world so he can scout some new wonder boy I might soon have to face. He's sick of the whole miserable thing. He sounds as if... Is it possible? Yes, I see it in his eyes. I know that look. He hates tennis. He says,
Don't put yourself through this anymore. After last night, you have nothing left to prove. I can't see you like this. It's too painful.
I reach out and touch his shoulder. I'm sorry, Pops. I can't quit. This can't end with me quitting. 30 minutes before the match, I get an anti-inflammatory injection, but it's different from the cortisone, less effective. Against my third-round opponent, Benjamin Becker, I'm barely able to remain standing. I look at the scoreboard. I shake my head. I ask myself over and over, how is it possible that my final opponent is a guy named B. Becker? I told Darren earlier this year that I wanted to go out against somebody I like and respect, or else against somebody I don't know. And so I get the latter. Becker takes me out in 4 sets. I can feel the tape of the finish line snap cleanly across my chest. U.S. Open officials, let me say a few words to the fans in the stands and at home before heading into the locker room. I know exactly what I want to say. I've known for years, but it still takes me a few moments to find my voice. The scoreboard said I lost today, but what the scoreboard doesn't say is what I have found. Over the last 21 years, I have found loyalty. You have pulled for me on the court, and also in life. I have found inspiration. You have willed me to succeed, sometimes even in my lowest moments. And I have found generosity. You have given me your shoulders to stand on, to reach for my dreams, dreams I could have never reached without you. Over the last 21 years, I have found you, and I will take you and the memory of you with me for the rest of my life. It's the highest compliment I know how to pay them. I've compared them to Gil. In the locker room, it's deathly quiet. I've noticed through the years that every locker room is the same when you lose. You walk in the door, which slams open because you've pushed it harder than you needed to. And the guys always scatter from the TV where they've been watching you get your ass kicked. They always pretend they haven't been watching, haven't been discussing you. This time, however, they remain gathered around the TV. No one moves. No one pretends. Then, slowly, everyone comes toward me. They clap and whistle, along with trainers and office workers, and James, the security guard. Only one man remains apart, refusing to applaud. I see him in the corner of my eye. He's leaning against a far wall with a blank look on his face and his arms tightly folded. Connors. He's now coaching Roddick. Poor Andy. It makes me laugh. I can only admire that Connors is who he is still, that he never changes. We should all be so true to ourselves, so consistent. I tell the players, You'll hear a lot of applause in your life, fellas, but none will mean more to you than that applause from your peers. I hope each of you hears that at the end. Thank you all. Goodbye. And take care of each other. The beginning. Rain has been falling off and on all day. Stephanie peers at the sky and says, What do you think? Come on, I say. Let's try. I'm willing if you are. Willing. She frowns. She's always willing, but she can't speak for her calf, which has been giving her problems since she retired. Especially lately. She looks down. Darned calf. She has a charity match in Tokyo next week. She's planning to raise money for a kindergarten she's opened in Eritrea, and even though it's only an exhibition, she wants to do well. She feels the old pressure to do well. Also, she can't help but wonder how much game she has left. I wonder the same thing about myself. It's been a year since I walked off the court for the last time at the U.S. Open. It's autumn 2007. So we've been planning all week to go out there, hit with each other. But now the day has come, and it's the one rainy day all year in Vegas. We can't build a fire in the rain. Stephanie looks again at the overcast sky, then at the clock. Busy day, she says. She has to pick up Jaden at school. We only have this small window. If the rain doesn't let up, if we don't hit, I might go down to my school, because that's where I go whenever I have time. I can't believe how it's grown. A 26,000-square-foot education complex with 500 students and a waiting list of 800. The $40 million campus features everything the kids could want. A high-tech TV production studio, a computer room with dozens of PCs along the walls, and a big, white, fluffy couch. A top-flight exercise room with machines as fancy as those at the most exclusive clubs in Vegas. There's a weight room, a lecture hall, and bathrooms as modern and clean as the ones in the city's finest hotels. Best of all, the place is still freshly painted and pristine, just as sparkling as it was on opening day. Students, parents, the neighborhood, everyone respects the school because everyone owns it. The area hasn't completely rebounded since we arrived. While I was giving a tour recently, someone was shot across the street. And yet, in 8 years, not one window has been broken. Not one wall has been sprayed with graffiti. Everywhere you look are little touches, subtle details that signify this school is different. This place is about excellence, through and through. On the front window is etched one large word, our unofficial school motto, believe. Every classroom is flooded with soft, natural daylight. Indirect, southern, bounced from skylights to high-tech reflectors. It's a diffuse glow that's ideal for reading and concentrating. Teachers never need to flick a light switch, which saves energy and money, but also spares students the headaches and general gloom caused by standard fluorescence, which I remember all too well. Our grounds are designed like a college campus with intimate quads and welcoming common areas. The walls are stone, muted purple and pale salmon quartzite from local quarries, and the walkways are lined with delicate plum trees, leading to one beautiful holly oak, a symbolic tree of hope, which we planted even before the groundbreaking. First things first, our architects figured, so they planted the tree of hope, then asked the construction workers to keep the tree watered and lighted while they built the school around it. The land on which the school sits is narrow, only 8 acres, but the lack of space actually suited the architect's overall scheme. They wanted the flow of the campus to symbolize a short, serpentine journey, like life. Wherever students stand, they can turn one way and see a glimpse of where they've been, or turn the other and see a hint of where they're headed. Kindergartners and elementary schoolers can gaze at the tall high school buildings, waiting for them, though they can't hear the voices of the older kids. We don't want to scare them. High schoolers can glance back at the primary classrooms from which they set out, though they can't hear the high-pitched screaming from the playground. We don't want to disturb them. The architects, local guys named Mike Delgado and Rob Gerdeson, threw themselves into this project. They spent months researching the history of the neighborhood, examining charter schools throughout the nation, experimenting with ideas. Then they stayed up night after night, brainstorming around a ping-pong table in Mike's basement. They built the first cardboard plywood model of the school on that ping-pong table, unaware of any coincidence or irony. It was their idea to have the buildings teach, to tell stories. We told them the stories we wanted told. In the middle school, we wanted enormous photos of Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, and, of course, Mandela, with their inspirational words painted on raised glass beneath their portraits. Since most of our students are African American, we asked Mike and Rob to embed bricks of marbled glass in one wall depicting the Big Dipper, and to the right, one single brick of glass representing the North Star. The Big Dipper and the North Star were beacons for runaway slaves, pointing them to freedom. My small contribution to the aesthetics of the school, in the common area of the high school building, I wanted a gleaming black Steinway. When I delivered the piano, all the students gathered around, and I shocked them by playing Lean on Me. What delighted me most was that the students didn't know who I was, and when their teachers told them, they weren't all that impressed. I dreamed of a school with the fewest possible dry routines, a place that fostered serendipity, a place where serendipity was the norm. And it's happened. On any given day, something cool is likely to happen at Agassiz Prep. President Bill Clinton might drop by and take a turn teaching history. Shaquille O'Neal might be the substitute in physical education. You might bump into Lance Armstrong walking the halls, or Muhammad Ali wearing a visitor badge, shadowboxing a freshman. You might look up at any moment and see Janet Jackson or Elton John standing in the door of a classroom, or members of Earth, Wind, and Fire auditing. More serendipity. When we dedicate the gymnasium, the NBA All-Star Game will be taking place in Vegas. We'll invite the rookie and sophomore All-Stars to play their traditional pickup game on our floor, the first game ever played at Agassiz Prep. The kids will love that. Our educators are the best, plain and simple. The goal in hiring them was to find sharp, passionate, inspired men and women who were willing to lay it on the line, to get personally involved. We ask one thing of every teacher, to believe that every student can learn. It sounds like a painfully obvious concept, self-evident, but nowadays it's not. Of course, because Agassiz Prep has a longer day and a longer year than other schools, our staff might earn less per hour than staffs elsewhere, but they have more resources at their fingertips, and so they enjoy greater freedom to excel and make a difference in children's lives. We thought it important that students wear uniforms. Tennis shirt with khaki pants, shorts, or skirt in official school colors, burgundy and navy. We think it creates less peer pressure, and we know it saves our parents money in the long run. Every time I walk into the school, I'm struck by the irony. I'm now the enforcer of a uniform policy. I look forward to the day when some Wimbledon official happens to be in Vegas and asks for a tour. I can hardly wait to see the look on his or her face when I mention my school's strict dress code. We have another code that might be my favorite feature of the school, the code of respect that begins each day. Whenever I'm down there, I poke my head into a random classroom and ask the children to stand with me and recite. The essence of good discipline is respect. Respect for authority and respect for others. Respect for self and respect for rules. It is an attitude that begins at home, is reinforced at school, and is applied throughout life. I promise them that if they memorize that simple code, keep it close to their hearts, they will go very far. Walking the halls, peering into the classrooms, I can see how the children value this place. I can hear it in their voices, discern it in their postures. From the teachers and staff, I've heard their stories, and I know the many ways this school enriches their lives. Also, we ask them to write personal essays, which we excerpt in the program for the yearly fundraiser. Not all the essays are about trials and hardships. Far from it. But those are the ones I remember. Like the girl living alone with her frail mother, who's been unable to work for years due to an incurable lung disease. They share a cockroach-infested apartment in a neighborhood ruled by gangs. So school is the girl's refuge. Her grades, she says, with touching pride, are outstanding. Because I rationalized that if I did well in school, no one would question what was going on at home, and I wouldn't have to tell my story. Now at 17, despite being forced to watch my mother deteriorate, to have lived with the Bloods and cockroaches, to work to support my family, I am college-bound. Another senior writes about her painful relationship with her father, who spent much of her childhood in jail. Recently, when he got out, she went to meet him and found him painfully thin, living with a haggard woman in a broken motorhome that reeked of sewage and crystal meth. Desperate not to repeat the mistakes of her parents, the girl pushes herself to succeed at Agassiz Prep. "I won't let myself down the way others have. It's up to me to change the course of my future, and I will never give up." Not long ago, while walking through the high school, I was flagged down by a boy. He was 15, shy, with soulful eyes and chubby cheeks. He asked if he could speak to me privately. "Of course," I said. We stepped into an alcove off the main hallway. He didn't know where to start. I told him, "Start at the beginning." "My life changed a year ago," he said. "My father died. He was killed. Murdered, you know." "I'm so sorry." "After that, I really lost my way. I didn't know what I was going to do." His eyes grew cloudy with tears. "Then I came to this school, and it gave me direction. It gave me hope. It gave me a life. So I've been keeping an eye out for you, Mr. Agassiz, and when you came by, I had to introduce myself and tell you, you know, thanks." I hugged him. I told him that it was I who needed to thank him. In the upper grades, the focus is squarely on college. The kids are told again and again that Agassiz Prep is only a stepping stone. "Don't get comfortable," we tell them. "College is the main goal." Should they happen to forget, reminders are everywhere. College banners line the walls. A main hallway is named College Street. A metal sky bridge between the two main buildings has never been used and never will be used until the first seniors receive their diplomas and embark for college in 2009. Walking across that bridge, the seniors will enter a secret room, sign their names in a ledger, and leave notes to the next class, and the next, and all senior classes to come. I can see myself addressing that first senior class. I'm already working with JP and Gil, obsessing over my speech. My theme, I think, will be contradictions. A friend suggests I brush up on Walt Whitman. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I never knew this was an acceptable point of view. Now I steer by it. Now it's my North Star, and that's what I'll tell the students. Life is a tennis match between polar opposites, winning and losing, love and hate, open and closed. It helps to recognize that painful fact early, then recognize the polar opposites within yourself, and if you can't embrace them or reconcile them, at least accept them and move on. The only thing you cannot do is ignore them. What other message could I hope to deliver? What other message could they expect from a ninth grade dropout whose proudest accomplishment is his school? "It stopped raining," Stephanie says. "Come on," I say. "Let's go." She pulls on a tennis skirt. I throw on some shorts. We drive to the public court down the street. In the little pro shop, the teenage girl behind the counter is reading a gossip magazine. She looks up, and her chewing gum almost falls out. "Hello," I say.
"Hi."
"Are you open?"
"Yeah."
"Could we rent a court for an hour?"
Yeah.
How much does it cost?
$14.
Okay. I hand her the money. She says,
You can have center court.
We walk downstairs to a mini amphitheater where a blue tennis court is surrounded by metal bleachers. We set down our bags side by side, then stretch and groan, teasing each other about how long it's been. I rummage in my bag for wristbands, tape, gum. Stephanie says,
Which side do you want?
This one.
I knew it.
She hits a forehand softly. I creak like the Tin Man as I lumber toward it, then punch it back. We have a gentle, tentative rally, and suddenly Stephanie laces a backhand up the line that sounds like a freight train going by. I shoot her a look. It's going to be like that, is it? She hits a Stephanie slice to my backhand. I sit down on my legs and cane it, hard as I can. I yell to her,
That shot has paid a lot of bills for us, baby.
She smiles and blows a lock of hair from her eyes. Our shoulders loosen, our muscles warm. The pace quickens. I strike the ball clean, hard, and my wife does the same. We shift from hitting without purpose to playing crisp points. She hits a wicked forehand. I hit a screaming backhand into the net. First backhand cross court I've missed in 20 years. I stare at the ball lying against the net. For a moment, it bothers me. I tell her it bothers me. I feel myself getting irritated. Then I laugh, and Stephanie laughs, and we begin again. With every swing, she's visibly happier. Her calf is feeling good. She thinks she'll be fine in Tokyo. Now that she's not worried about the injury, we can play, really play. Soon, we're having so much fun that when the rain comes, we don't notice. When the first spectator arrives, we don't notice him either. One by one, more arrive. Faces appear throughout the bleachers as one person presumably phones another person, who phones two more people, to tell them we're out here, on a public court, playing for nothing but pride. Like Rocky Balboa and Apollo Creed, after the lights are off and the gym is locked. The rain falls harder, but we ain't stopping. We're going all out. The people who show up now have cameras. Flashes go off. They seem unusually bright, reflected and magnified by the raindrops. I don't care, and Stephanie doesn't notice. We're not fully conscious of anything but the ball, the net, each other. A long rally. 10 strokes, 15. It ends with me missing. The court is strewn with balls. I scoop up 3, put 1 in my pocket. I yell to Stephanie,
Let's both come back. What do you say?
She doesn't answer.
You and me, I say. We'll announce it this week.
Still no answer. Her concentration, as usual, puts mine to shame. In the same way she wastes no movement on the court, she never wastes words. JP points out that the 3 most influential people in my life, my father, Gil, Stephanie, aren't native English speakers, and with all 3, their most powerful mode of communication may be physical. She's engrossed in each shot. Each shot is important. She never tires, never misses. It's a joy to watch her, but also a privilege. People ask what it's like, and I can never think of the perfect word, but that word comes close, a privilege. I miss again. She squints, waits. I serve. She returns, then gives the Stephanie wave, as if swatting a mosquito, meaning she's done. Time to pick up Jaden. She walks off the court.
Not yet, I tell her.
What? She stops, looks at me. Then she laughs.
Okay,
she says, backpedaling to the baseline. It makes no sense, but it's who I am, and she understands. We have things to do, wonderful things. She can't wait to go and get started, and neither can I. But I also can't help it. I want to play just a little while longer. This is Eric Davies. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Open, an Autobiography by Andre Agassi. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2009 by Andre Agassi. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc.